Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
As a translator, you don't always know what's going to come through your letterbox in the next jiffy bag. And when Alain's book came through mine, letterbox in, I think, 2006, I have to confess I'd never actually read any of his work before. Probably my fault rather than his. And when you come across a new book that you have to translate, the first thing you think about is how, once you've read it, is how you can possibly hope to put yourself inside the skin of the person who's written it. And when I looked at Alan and when I looked at me, it seemed to be quite a daunting prospect. And I'd like to start off by reading a passage from Broken Glass, which is the book that I first translated by him, in which a young man from the Congo, who's with a white woman, French woman, and is engaged to be married to her, goes to visit her, his future parents-in-law. And I think the passage gives you a very good sense of what it's like to be possibly someone a bit like Alain, trying to explain where he's coming from. The girl is called Céline. Céline quickly talked her parents around. They're not racist. They always voted communist in municipal and regional elections, or for the Greens and the presidential. So we went to visit them in some little place in the Vendée called Noirmoutier, an island with a bridge connecting it to the mainland. And Céline's parents said I was a fine young man, distinguished, intelligent, refined, ambitious, respectful of Republican values, and I was pleased to hear this description of my noble qualities. They admired the way I was dressed, which isn't surprising because I was actually wearing a made-to-measure Francesco Smalto suit. And they said how they loved deepest Africa, the real Africa, mysterious Africa, the bush, the red earth, the wild animals skipping about in the wide open spaces, adding that only fools thought that black Africa was heading for disaster or that Africa was anti-development, and they apologised personally for the mistakes of the past, in particular the slave trade, colonisation, problems with independence, and all the other shit some black fundamentalists have made their thing. I didn't want to get into those worn-out arguments. I made it clear to them stuff to do with the past was not my thing. I was a man with my eyes fixed firmly on the horizon, and that horizon was not aflame. I said I was looking to the future, and then I began talking to them about the Congo, and they asked which Congo I was from originally, and the father asked if it was the Belgian Congo, and the mother asked if it was the French Congo, and I said the Belgian Congo no longer existed, and I said the French Congo no longer existed either, and I explained that I was from the Republic of the Congo, i.e. the smaller of the two Congos, and the father exclaimed, of course he's from the little Congo, our beautiful, illustrious former colony. General de Gaulle even declared Brazzaville the capital of free France during the occupation. Ah, the Congo, land of dreams and freedom. It's the country where they speak the purest French, you know, better even than in France, let me tell you. And Céline's mother, who was a bit embarrassed, told her husband he shouldn't be using the word colony in reference to my country. Now then, Joseph, she said, it doesn't do to say colony, you know that. And the father said it was a mistake, and what he meant was territory. And the mother said that colony and territory were completely interchangeable. And Céline flew into a rage and said, we haven't come to talk about interchanges or geography or history. And old Father Joseph said, good boy, let's drink to that with a decent bottle of claret, shall we? Mm-hmm. And he opened the claret and we drank.
Merci.
So I don't know if you're familiar with the plot of Broken Glass. Broken Glass is the name of the principal character in this novel. There's a picture of him. And the conceit of the book is that Broken Glass, who's a disgraced school teacher and an alcoholic and has been abandoned by his long-suffering wife, spends most of his days and nights in a bar called Le Crédit à Voyager. I don't know where that title came from. We chose to translate it as Credit Gone West, which is slightly more meaning than is actually in the French. Where did you? I think you came across the title actually in a real bar.
It's a mix of two Céline's book in French, Voyage au bout de la nuit and Mort à crédit. So I tried to put Le Crédit à Voyager so that it was a kind of homage. I wanted to express in that book, because I read a lot of books from Céline's, and I like the way he tried to write in French with his kind of broken French. And since it's not that usual to find French writers who are dealing with the language, trying to put it in a kind of vulgar way. Yeah, so Credit Gone West or Le Crédit a Voyager, it's a kind of clin d'œil to my readings of Céline.
Yeah, I bet there are hundreds of similar clin d'œil throughout the text. Broken glass, that the narrator, or rather the scribe, because he writes down stories, is sitting in this bar, and as he sits, all these characters come in, and seeing that he's been given a notebook by the man who owns the bar, whose name is the Stubborn Snail,
mm-hmm.
and he is Broken Glass's friend, and he gives the Stubborn Snail this notebook and says, I want you to write down the stories of all the people who come into this bar. And many of the people who come into the bar are wretched people with terrible stories, but as they tell the stories to Broken Glass, he writes them down. And they become very funny. Maybe Alan, would you write? Do you, who wants to read? Them? I don't know. Does anybody here? Should we read a bit in French? Or?
Oh.
I'm going to ask Alan to read the opening in the French, and and then if anybody wants, we can do it in English after.
Disons que le patron du bar, Le Crédit a Voyagé, m'a remis un cahier que je dois remplir. Et il croit dur comme fer que moi, verre cassé, je peux pondre un livre parce que, en plaisantant, je lui avais raconté un jour l'histoire d'un écrivain célèbre qui buvait comme une éponge, un écrivain qu'on allait même ramasser dans la rue quand il était ivre. Faut donc pas plaisanter avec le patron, parce qu'il prend tout au premier degré. Et lorsqu'il m'avait remis ce cahier, il avait tout de suite précisé que c'était pour lui tout seul, que personne d'autre ne le lirait. Et alors j'ai voulu savoir pourquoi il tenait tant à ce cahier. Il a répondu qu'il ne voulait pas que le crédit à voyager disparaisse un jour comme ça. Il ajoutait que les gens de ce pays n'avaient pas le sens de la conservation de la mémoire, que l'époque des histoires que racontait la grammaire grabataire était finie, que l'heure était désormais à l'écrit, parce que c'est ce qui reste. La parole, c'est de la fumée noire, du pipi de chat sauvage. Le patron du crédit à voyager n'aime pas les formules toutes faites du genre « En Afrique, quand un vieillard meurt, c'est une bibliothèque qui brûle ». Et lorsqu'il entend ce cliché bien développé, il est plus que vexé et lance aussitôt « Ça dépend de quel vieillard. Arrêtez donc vos conneries. Je n'ai confiance qu'en ce qui est écrit. » Ainsi, c'est un peu pour lui faire plaisir que je griffonne de temps à autre sans vraiment être sûr de ce que je raconte ici. Je ne cache pas que je commence à y prendre goût depuis un certain temps. Toutefois, je me garde de le lui avouer, sinon il s'imaginerait des choses et me pousserait encore plus à l'ouvrage. Or, je veux garder ma liberté d'écrire quand je veux, quand je peux. Il n'y a rien de pire que le travail forcé. Je ne suis pas son nègre. J'écris aussi pour moi-même. C'est pour cette raison que je n'aimerais pas être à sa place au moment où il parcourra ces pages dans lesquelles je ne tiens à ménager personne. Mais quand il lira tout ça, je ne serai plus un client de son bar. J'irai traîner mon corps squelettique ailleurs. Je lui aurai remis le document à la dérobée en lui disant « Mission terminée ».
Thank you. The opening passage of the book sums up very well the constant tension between the parole, mm-hmm. the spoken word of the characters who come into the bar, and the ambition of Vercassé to write. And Broken Glass, the main character, is somebody who has an immense culture in a way. He's read an enormous amount of books,
mm-hmm.
but in a way has had no ability to do anything with them. And throughout the text, I don't know if you noticed, but there are no full stops in the entire book. Here we go. There are no full stops, only commas, mm-hmm. and blanks for brief silences. And throughout the text, I think I counted, there were between 200 and 300 titles of both French classics and African novels. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that as the translator, I was usually, when I came across the title of a French classic, I was usually fairly sure what it was. Mm. But because they're not signposted at all, I quickly discovered that there are a huge number of African novels which are listed or which are sewn into the text, which I was not familiar with. So in a way, reading Broken Glass is an excellent way of building up a list of things you ought to read. but in a way, because I know it was actually a technique that was used by another writer in Devoir de Violence. Mm-hmm. I think he also, what's the name?
Yambo Wologem.
He used the same technique in one of his novels, A Duty to Violence, and was much criticized for not having pointed out to people that this is what he was doing, as though somehow these borrowings were not entirely legitimate. Mm. And somebody else suggested that he might italicize them, but I think you would have lost rather a lot if you'd done that. In a way, they're then meant to be there like creases in a sheet, that they're things that slightly trip you up. But
No, I wanted in this book to show my own, what can I say, library, you know, the must-read books in my childhood and when I was growing, because I went to law school. I was supposed to be a lawyer to satisfy my mother. So every day she would say, you need to be a lawyer so that I'm not going to have trouble in my life. There's a lot of problems in the Congo, so if you are a lawyer or at least a judge, that's going to be fine for me. So that's the way I went to law school. But I wasn't satisfied. I didn't want to be a lawyer wearing a kind of robe or something, being like talking about rules and dealing with people who have, lost their dogs or cats, and I don't know, whatever. So I wanted to be just a kind of kid who is dreaming another life. So I went to law school at that time, but I was reading during that time also books. So when I moved to France, I was still writing poetry and so on and so on, and I discovered a lot of books, a lot of novels, mainly Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Mario Vargas Llosa, and Russian writers such as Dostoevsky, Pasternak, Gogol, and so on and so on. And when I was living in the United States of America in Michigan, you know, the winter is very tough over there, like you need to stay home. You don't need to go outside because it's very cold. That the time I began to write Broken Glass. So I was surrounded by all my books. I was looking in my library, at my library, and saying, maybe the book, when I'm sleeping, all my books are talking something against me. So I need to do something in order to respond at that time. So how can I deal with like 250 books I like in my life? So I say that, okay, I'm going to have all the titles of the book and making them like a kind of mixed. That's why when if you read Broken Glass, by reading, you're going to say, oh, I know this novel, oh, I know this novel, but I didn't want to put a kind of a glossaire, like we say in the end of the book, pointing to people, oh, here is the Heart of Darkness from Conrad, and so on and so on. There's a lot of African books in it, but a lot of European books, a lot of American books, like Hemingway, Steinbeck, John Steinbeck, Les Raisins de la Colère, I don't know the title in English. Yes, yes, or of Mice and... Yes, okay, so that's the book I was reading at that time. So the challenge was that how can I write about all that book without disturbing the readers. So I invented this kind of narrator. We used to drink day in and day out, sitting in the bar and contemplating every people of there. So he's a teacher. So as a matter of fact, he likes reading. So I didn't need to put a lot of punctuation. So that's why the only punctuation was like virgule, comma, the comma over there, no stop, full stop or nothing. Because if you are drinking, you're not going to stop talking. So it's like someone who is still talking and talking and talking.
I got the feeling also that he had, it was one of those cases where as long as you keep talking, nothing too terrible will happen. And yes. In fact, the story of Broken Glass himself is included within the novel, and it's a very sad story. Mm-hmm. In fact, the second half of the novel is largely devoted to his telling his own story. Mm-hmm. And one of the dominant features in his own story is the death of his mother. Mm-hmm. I know that when you were living in Paris and had left Congo 4 or 5 years later, your mother died without your having seen her since you left, and that was a very... I think all your novels are dedicated to your mother.
Yes, I think in this case we can say that as a novelist, even if you are writing your novel, you're going to put your own life in order to create something which is realistic. So the second part, it's a kind of my own biography I'm trying to do. But it's Vercassé. He's talking about his mother, and he wants to find where is his mother. And I think that the saddest part of the book, when Vercassé is trying to tell people about his own life, because he was supposed to write the lives of the other, like we say, but finally he discovered himself writing about his own life. And maybe all my books are written to my mother, because he wasn't able to read French. She was like, we say in French, analphabete. She couldn't read, so she didn't know even what a writer is. The first time I wrote a book of poetry and I gave it to her, she was trying to pass the pages and say, but there's no image in your book. Huh? Because do you think that that's what you want to do in your life? Writing, yes.
In the preface to your collection of poetry, you write to your mother, and you address her as the person who made me a poet, which is very touching. But to go back to Vercassé, I was very intrigued because all these characters come into the bar, and to some extent they're archetypes as a man who, qui a fait la France, the man in question in the first passage I read. And there are other people whose lives have come unstuck, usually through sex or drink or related activities. And when the final character who comes into the bar is strangely familiar, and he's the only white character in the novel. And I'll describe him to you and see whether you recognize him. He wears a red baseball cap, and he's American, and he's in his 30s, and he's carrying a copy of a novel of which only the last 3 words of the title are visible, which are In the Rye.
And that was a cutter.
So we quickly realize that this is Holden Caulfield, and we're not quite sure what he's doing in this bar, but he's trying to catch, as in fact all the other characters are trying to catch Broken Glass's eye, so that they say that he'll put them in his book, because it seems to me that all of their ambition really is to get in a book, and so to leave the domain of the spoken word and to get written down. And Holden Caulfield is recognizable because he keeps spouting a particular section from Catcher in the Rye about when he's in a taxi and he asks the taxi driver what happens to the little ducks on the lake in Central Park in the winter. And it seems to be the most sort of, it's a fairly unimportant question, but it's one on which he harps all the time. It becomes his sort of trademark question. I wanted to ask you why you put Holden Caulfield in the novel. And what his significance there was to you?
I think it was my my own itinerary. I was born in Africa, and I went to France, and I'm living in United States of America. It was like the end, for the time being, of my voyage. Since I'm living in the United States of America, I thought that it would be great to end the novel with a kind of opening to the United States of America, maybe in the hope of writing one day a kind of African novel in the United States of America. So I tried to put Caulfield in that in my novel. He came over there like someone we didn't expect to come over there and asking such a question to Broken Glass. But the narrator was already tired. He said that, I don't want to go jump into that question. My novel is over, so I don't want to hear anything about United States of America. And he was like angry against the United States of America. So that was my part, to be a little bit like exhausted about the fact that usually everybody in France asks me to write about America, but I can't for the time being. I need to regret a territory before writing about that, so I don't feel that I'm ready to write about that. Maybe Broken Glass was in the same situation, so meeting this kind of character in Africa, who is talking about ducks, winter, Central Park. He said, oh, you're not going to impress me with United States of America. So I've already traveled in my life. That's what he said. I used to travel through the books, so he was everywhere. So he won't be like amazed just because you are talking about United States.
It wasn't, in fact, the first time you'd had a reference to an American novel in your work, because African Psycho actually came out shortly after you moved to America.
Yes.
And presumably shortly after you'd read American Psycho.
Mm-hmm. Actually, African Psycho was released before Broken Glass. And I was already experimenting a kind of narration in which the word would be very important. In African Psycho, the main character called Grégoire Nakobomayo, when he is hungry, he's like talking a lot for like 10 pages, just comma, 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 and comma. So I think that if I wrote Broken Glass, it's thanks to African Psycho, which was a kind of my first influence to the United States of America, the serial killer. But I wanted to depict a kind of bad serial killer. He wants to kill, but he's not succeeding. So it's a kind of frustration. I was like astonished to see that when I'm reading like Bret Easton Ellis' American Psycho, the crime is very perfect, you know, well-dressed, voila, Umberto something, Giorgio Armani, and in the day he's working, and when the night comes, he's killing people perfectly. So I wanted to put a serial killer who is not succeeding. You want to kill, but it's not that, and so on and so on. Yeah.
Before I ask you, because the book I've just finished translating, Memoirs of a Porcupine, is also about serial killing, so before I ask you why you really write so much about serial killing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to...
Don't be afraid, I'm not going to do anything.
I just wanted to read another short passage from Broken Glass about language and what you're trying to do when you write. This is when Stubborn Snail, the owner of the bar, is again insisting that Broken Glass become a writer because he thinks he has a gift for it. I'm just seeing how much I can dare read, because it's so good that I want to read lots of it. But I said to the stubborn snail that if I was a writer, I would ask God to grant me the gift of humility, to give me the strength to put my own writing into perspective alongside the giants of this world who put pen to paper. And I would say three cheers for true genius and would keep silent rather than speak of the mediocrity all around us. And that would be the only way you could hope to write anything remotely like real life. But I'd say it in my own words, twisted words, incoherent words, nonsensical words. I'd write down words as they came to me. I'd begin awkwardly. I'd finish as awkwardly as I'd begun. And to hell with pure reason and method and phonetics and prose. And in this shit-poor language of mine, things would seem clear in my head, but come out wrong. And the worst to say, it wouldn't come easy, so it would be a choice between writing or life. That's right. And what I really want people to say when they read me is, what is this jumble, this mess, this muddle, this mishmash of barbarities, this empire of science, this chit-chat, this descent to the dregs of belles lettres? What is with this barnyard prattle? Is this stuff for real? Where does it start? Where the hell does it end? And my mischievous answer would be, this jumble of words is life. Come on, come into my lair. Check out the rotting garbage. Here's my take on life. Your fiction's no more than the output of a load of old has-beens designed to comfort other old has-beens. And until the day your characters start to see how the rest of us earn our nightly crust, there'll be no such thing as literature, only intellectual masturbation with you all rubbing up against each other like donkeys. And to sum up, I said to the stubborn snail that sadly, I wasn't a writer. I couldn't be a writer. All I ever did was watch the world and talk to my bottles and my tree, the one I like to piss under, to whom I'd made a promise to come back in vegetal form and live a new life alongside it. And because of that, I would rather leave the job of writing to the intellectually gifted, the writers I so loved to read in the days when I still read in order to learn. I would leave writing, I said, to those who sing of the joy of life, who struggle, who dream without ceasing of the extension of the domain of the struggle, who invent fancy ways of dancing the polka, who can astonish the gods, who wallow in disgrace, those who walk steadfastly towards manhood, those who create a practical dream, those who sing of the land without shadows, those who live in transit in one corner of the earth, those who see the world through an attic window, like those who, like my late father, listen to jazz, drink palm wine, those who can describe an African summer, who tell tales of barbarous weddings, who retreat to the summit of the magic rock of Tanyas and spend their time in meditation. I told him I'd read writing to those who remind us that too much sun kills love, those who prophesy the sobbing of the white man, phantom Africa, the innocence of the black child. I told him I'd leave writing to those who can construct a town inhabited by dogs, or a house on the edge of tears to shelter the humble and the homeless, those who sense the compassion of stones. Yes, I told him I'd leave writing to them and rule out the nutters and the live wires and the weekend poets with their threepenny verses and the guys who think a black man couldn't speak of birch trees, of stone, of dust, of winter, of snow, of a rose, or simply of beauty for beauty's sake, and rule out the integrationalist imitators that bop up like mushrooms. How many are their number who congest the highway of letters, sully the purity of the universe and pollute the true literature of our time? A lot has been said, Alan, about the difficulty of being an African writer, whether writing in a European language.
Mm-hmm.
I think Coetzee said that the Russians write for the Russians and the French write for the French,
mm-hmm.
but the Africans write for the Europeans. Is that your experience?
Well, I don't think so. You know, I quoted Coetzee here, disgrace, when you are reading, I saw a lot of title over there, disgrace, the other one. I don't think that African write for Europeans only. I think that we are translated into in Israel, in South Africa sometimes, and so on and so on. I think that when I'm writing, I never think who is going to read my work. And I think that I used to write sometimes against Europe civilization, even if I'm using that civilization to write my own novel. It's to express that European people don't have what we call the monopoly of the civilization. So at that time, if like Dostoevsky wrote for Russian, I wouldn't understand like what he's writing about, or Pushkin writing his poem just for Russian people, I wouldn't understand. When I'm reading a novel, I used to feel like I'm living in that country. If I'm reading 100 Years of Solitude from Marquez, I feel like I'm in Macondo, that village in which you're going to see Aurelia Buendia, the main character, with his descendant and so on, roaming about, going to the bush, being magical and so on and so on. So literature is the field of the dreams. So it's the only chance we have to dream another kind of the world. So even if I'm writing about the Congo, I'm sure that when someone from Japan is reading, or from China is reading my book, he's gonna feel that he's in the Congo. So the main or the most important thing is in literature is to create from the local something which is going to be open to the world. And then I think that we used to write from to someone who's going to understand or feel the same thing we were feeling at the time we were writing the books. So I never divide the readers. I never think once that I'm writing for European people or something like that. And I used to meet a lot of Congolese people saying that, yes, when I was reading your book, I felt at home. It was like my book. At the same time, if I go to France, the deep France, someone gonna say that it's like here. People drinking in the bar and talking about life of the other. It's I went to Poland, it was the same thing. They were talking about the novel, or even in North Korea. I know that they are losing in the World Cup, but it's okay. They feel like it's their book. So
you don't feel that you're specifically describing, particularly in Broken Glass, African problems which the rest of the world needs to know about, but rather that you're describing universal problems which...
Yes, we are in a small world. Even if something is happening in the Congo, which is a small country, I think that it's also a problem for the other nations. So I don't think at all that a writer should write only for, is committed to write for his own country. You have to open the doors. You have to express your own culture to the world, to say to the world that we will reach the universality if we include the kind of local literature that gives us an enormous situation of culture. So you have just to think that living in the Congo when I was like 17 or 18, when I was reading Marcel Proust writing about bourgeoisie. I don't know what is bourgeoisie, I don't know what is Monsieur Swan, nice dress, but I was thinking it was in the bush in our situation. Proust was close to me, and when I got to France, I was like disappointed. I say, I don't see bourgeois in the streets, but they are in the books. That's the magical situation, and you're going to find someone who never go to Africa, but is feeling that it's close, it's written in France. But we are not sure that it's the French from the Académie Française. It's French, but the rhythm is not French. Mm. It's a kind of song behind that. And if you close your eyes, you're going to feel like the drums from my own country. I'm speaking or writing in French, but if you see beneath, you're going to find something else. Like I'm refusing a kind of way of writing in the classical way. I don't want to be like a slave for the Académie Française or something like that. I want to express my French with a kind of phrase which is broken and so on and so on.
Yeah. There's a particular challenge to a translator to be able to render the rhythm and the intonation and the song in the French original. And do you ever find that you come into under criticism in Africa for your passionate commitment to French culture?
And at the first time, I received a letter from an African reader. He told me, yes, I read Broken Glass. I'm very shocked because you quoted only European literatures. So when I'm in Europe, people say, you quoted only African literature. But in fact, it's like half-half. You have like 40 or 50 African writers, Asian, including like, they don't see like a writer like Kenza Biro Owe, who won the Nobel Prize, who is from Japan. They just see like Mishima. So it depends on people. If you are not like accustomed to read Asian literature, you won't find Kenza Biro Owe passing by there, or Mishima, or I don't know, or Arabic writers. So I was laughing because I told to the guy, "You Broken Glass is a kind of book. Each time you are reading, you're gonna discover another thing." So I said, "Oh, I passed this phrase, but it's maybe Mario Vargas Llosa, it's maybe Horacio Quiroga, or something." You say, "Oh, it's Marcel Proust, or it's Sonny Labutansi from Congo, or Ferdinand Oyono, or Aimé Césaire from Martinique, or Hemingway." And so it's a large panel on it. So I think that that was just a letter, but in fact, African people think that it's only about Africa, and European people think that it's about European literature, and that's fine because they can struggle together and I can be the referee.
Alain is now professor of Francophone literature at the University of California in Los Angeles. Francophone literature has recently been redefined, I think, as littérature du monde en français, partly because I think of some maybe negative associations with the term francophonia.
Yes, just because in France they used to call us francophone writers, but they never call like Michel Houellebecq or Marie Darrieussecq francophone writers. So that's curious. Francophone writers should mean someone who is writing in French. But they use the term francophone writer to qualify people who are writing in French but who are not French. So it's a kind of discrimination. So we didn't want this discrimination. That's why we tried to explain to France that nowadays, if French literature is strong, it's just because the writers are not only from France. You see Amadou Kourouma from Ivory Coast, Edouard Glissant or Césaire from Martinique, Fatou Diom from Senegal, Amil Malou from Lebanon, Tar Ben Jeloun from Morocco, and so on and so on. It's a large panel. And even on translation, I think that 80% of translation from French into the other language came from writers who are not French. So, as a matter of fact, we have to give another explanation of French literature. So,
that French literature is a part of Francophonia rather than Francophonia?
I think that French literature is a part of Francophone literature and not the contrary. They think that Francophone literature is a part of French literature. That's not the case.
Have you told Mr.
Sarkozy that? I wrote something in a book called Literature Monde en Français. And sometimes if you are in United States of America, they used to introduce me like a French writer. That's the first time, you know, I'm in United. So we're going to receive the French writer. So I was astonished. I looked at my bag. I was thinking that maybe Philippe Claudel was behind me. Not it was me. So that was the case. And but things are changing every time, day in and day out, because years because it wasn't acceptable in France to see like an African to win like Goncourt or Renaudot. So as long as you won a prize, which is considered like the main prize in France, they're gonna forget that you are a Francophone writer.
Although yes. I think in 2006 or 2007, it must have been rather difficult to ignore, because I think you won a prize and Nancy Houston won a prize and Jonathan Little, all of you writing in French but none of you born in France.
Yes, and in 2006 I was introduced like a French writer. French writer born in the Congo. So it was like, I said, yes, he's French. And when I went in the Congo, my country, invited by the minister over there to present the Ronaldo, he said that, yes, I'm very disappointed. So you are now a French writer. We need you to be a Congolese writer. So I didn't know. Now I used to say Franco-Congolais. So that...
But I noticed that in the a page which I read about the course that you ran at UCLA, you say the only question I ask when I look at a text is this text in French? And if it is, then it is something which your students will pay attention to, whatever the source of the origin of the writing.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about that the book that you won the Prix Renaudot for, which is called Memoirs of a Porcupine, which I've just finished translating.
Thank you.
Which will be published next year. Yes, next year.
Thank you.
In which the narrator is rather different from the narrators in Broken Glass, not least by the fact that he's an animal. He's a porcupine.
Serial killer.
He's a serial killer as well.
Animal.
And could you just explain to us briefly what the idea behind that book is and where it came from?
It was a fable. My mother used to tell me this kind of fable in order to frighten me, you know. At 7, if I'm not in the bed, you know, I'm going to tell you the story of the porcupine. And then I was like, hola. So it was a kind of called porcupine who is killing people every time. But that animal was linked with a man called Kibandi, because in our beliefs, when you are born, you came with your double, which is animal. So you're going to live together with your animal. For instance, if I have a porcupine, the day I'm going to die, the porcupine is going to die the same day. But in the novel, that guy called Kibandi has a double, which is a porcupine. The day the guy died, the porcupine was waiting for the moment to die. So the animal realized that he's not dying. So he said that, oh, I'm going to write quickly my memoirs to explain to the world what kind of relation we had together. And then it was to explain the 99 people they killed before killing the 100 or 101, because it was twins at that time. So he tried to explain everything, how he came to the world, how he was working with his guide, when he discovered love, because it was a kind of porcupine. He needed to go away from his own group of animals to leave just behind the house of Kibandi. and then they were living with such a kind of life, and he explained how he did kill 99 people on behalf of his master, who was Kibandi. So he's trying to explain to the people, is it the animal or the human being who is like responsible of the killings? So it's a kind of philosophical problem. It's for me, the real homage I gave to my mother, to say that, oh, you were threatening me, but I'm going to write a novel about that. Since you are not alive, I'm going to try to put a lot of liars in it. So it's like this kind of animal is aware of everything. He can understand philosophy. He read a lot of books, mainly Luis Sepulveda's. He read Horacio Quiroga, Alan Edgar Poe, who it is from here, you know. He read that, I read it in French, Histoire Extraordinaire. You saw that murder or something. So that animal used to read Poe and feel that how it works with a human being and so on and so on. So I kept this kind of connection with books, even if I'm talking about deep Africa with beliefs, with kind of mockery.
Because it's a very different Africa you described to the Africa in Broken Glass. It's rural, and in a way it corresponds to what we might have as preconceptions about what should constitute an African story. Mm-hmm. And in fact it is a spoken story, because the porcupine, when he finds that he's survived his master, he goes and sits under the tree, the baobab tree, and he tells the tree the stories of his life. And you sense that he has a great feeling of guilt about what he's done in a way, but that he has no sense of... He does have a sense of the gravity of what they've done of killing these 99 people. Mm-hmm. But in a way, his spoken account of it is in some way his justification and his excuse.
Yes, he's trying to explain to people that I'm not guilty. It's because of Kibandi. Mm-hmm. So he need to explain how it works, how is the connection between a man or a human being and an animal. There's a kind of mystery I try to explain in the book. And at the same time, I met a lot of African people who said that, yes, that's how it works. Mm-hmm. And they were thinking that I would belong to a kind of secret group, who is like considered like sorcier in our country. So it was strange to explain this kind of mystery to people. But I used to meet African people who think that it was my comeback to the deep Africa, because Broken Glass was urban, in the city, in the real and current Africa, drinking, street, and so. And Broken Glass is African philosophy, the way we explain the world, the way we explain how the world was created, and how we need as Africans to consider the world for the future.
And in fact, all your novels have in common the fact that they all contain their own Genesis story. They all contain an explanation of how this text came into being. Mm-hmm. And at the end of Memoirs of a Porcupine, we get a letter written by the stubborn snail, who is the man who owned the bar in Broken Glass, who says that he didn't realize at the time, but in fact a second notebook has turned up. And this is actually the second novel by Broken Glass, which was written shortly before his death. I don't know if you'd like me to read, or whether you'd like to read the opening to Memoirs of a Porcupine in English.
Okay.
Would you like?
Yes.
I've got the right one.
Okay.
In English or in?
In French, I think my reading is bad, so.
So if you want to read a little bit in French, and then maybe I can read the same thing in English.
Okay, just the opening. Yeah. Okay. Donc, je ne suis qu'un animal. Un animal de rien du tout. Les hommes diraient une bête sauvage. Comme si on ne comptait pas de plus bête et de plus sauvage que nous dans leur espèce. Pour eux, je ne suis qu'un porc-épic. Et puisqu'ils ne se fient qu'à ce qu'ils voient, ils déduiraient que, Je n'ai rien de particulier, que j'appartiens au rang des mammifères munis de longs piquants. Ils ajouteraient que je suis incapable de courir aussi vite qu'un chien de chasse, que la paresse m'astreint à ne pas vivre loin de l'endroit où je me nourris. À vrai dire, je n'ai rien à envier aux hommes. Je me moque de leur prétendue intelligence, puisque j'ai moi-même été pendant longtemps le double de l'homme qu'on appelait Kibandi et qui est mort avant-hier. Moi, je me tairais la plupart du temps non loin du village. Je ne rejoignais cet homme que plus tard dans la nuit, lorsque je devais exécuter les missions précises qu'il me confiait. Je suis conscient des représailles que j'aurais subies de sa part s'il m'avait entendu de son vivant me confesser comme maintenant, avec une liberté de ton qu'il aurait prise pour de l'ingratitude parce que, mine de rien, il aura cru sa vie entière que je lui devais quelque chose, que je n'étais qu'un pauvre figurant, qu'il pouvait décider de mon destin comme bon lui semblait. Eh bien, sans vouloir tirer la couverture de mon côté, je peux aussi dire la même chose à son égard, puisque sans moi, il n'aurait été qu'un misérable légume. Sa vie d'humain n'aurait même pas valu 3 gouttelettes de pipi du vieux porc-épic qui nous gouvernait à l'époque où je faisais encore partie du monde animal.
This may be a really naive question, but it really troubled me all the time I was translating it. So which of them is responsible, the animal or the man?
Now, if I give the solution now, Pete from Serpentail will say, what happened here? That's not good. It's a kind of question you need to... You need to know what happened, really, because sometimes people are going to say the human being or the animal because of the fact that we used to respect animal in our country, like you here in Europe. You have people talking to animal, oh, sweetie, come here, and so giving. You have hospital from animal, cemetery from animal. So we have animal over there. And this fable, it's about the respect of the nature. You have to respect the trees, you have to respect the animal. Sometimes if you are cutting the tree, maybe you are cutting the head of your own ancestor, because sometimes your ancestor is maybe a cow, a baobab, the baobab tree, a palm wine tree, and so on and so on. So the book is dealing about the shock of civilization, how to respect the nature, animals, vegetation, and human being, how we can deal with our relation between human being and animals. So I prefer to let people to decide who is the responsible of our life.
The porcupine has a sort of background culture in La Fontaine, which he received from the elder of his group of porcupines before he went to live with men. But it seems that the kind of moral fable here is very different to a La Fontaine moral, where there is very clearly an answer about what is right and wrong.
Because I don't like to judge people, I prefer to put the fact on the table and then people will decide what's going to happen there. In La Fontaine, you're going to read the fable, you know that at the end of the fable, you're going to say, yes, among our enemies, we have to fear the smaller one and so on. And so on. Then you know that, but I prefer the fact and then to let people to express their own judgment instead of giving the moral and so on and so on. That the way my mother was telling me the story, and that at the end of the story, she would ask me, so what do you think? Who is responsible, the animal or the human being? So on Monday, I would say the animal, but on Tuesday I'm going to say the human being and so on and so on. So it depends maybe of my behavior or what I did during the day.
One thing that struck me also is that the fables of La Fontaine, if there's one thing they're not about, it's animals. Mm-hmm. They're all about humans, and which is not the case entirely here, because, as you say, nature is very important. Mm. I think we've talked for a long time. Does anybody have any questions for Ella? I hope so.
And for you too, as a translator.
Actually, I need to start with one translation question. And the first passage that you read, there's a moment at which Broken Glass says, when he's considering whether or not he'll write this version of events and characters for the owner of the bar, he says, "Je ne suis pas son nègre," which I was quite puzzled by originally. I mean, in French, if you say, "Je ne suis pas son nègre," it means a nègre is somebody who ghosts.
Ghostwriter.
It seemed to be very problematic as how to. And we did actually translate it in the end as "I'm not his ghost," which I wasn't very happy about because I didn't feel it was strong enough. And although it had the black white connotation, it didn't seem really to convey the original.
They use nègre for someone who is writing for another writer, in this case, because the word nègre in writing was invented because of Alexandre Dumas. He has a black blood. So people was writing for him, and the critics said that this Negro, at the time, this Negro, and then the word nègre become for us ghostwriter at the time. So I tried to play it with that. Yeah. Sometimes you can have your nègre, but he's white. Like you are a black writer, but your nègre is white behind you. So it was a kind of joke about that word, and maybe a kind of homage to Alexandre Dumas.
Who, somebody else like to ask a question?
It's great to hear you today, by the way.
Thank you.
It has been said by several African authors that African literature can only be engaged in literature engagement. And I was wondering what you think about that, if you think it's true.
Yes, and I see that in the prospectus of the festival, they say that I'm very engaged. So, yes, I think that being a writer, it does mean that you're going to try to explain the world. You're going to try to give your opinion through the character and so on and so on. So, for African, it's very complicated because we came from a tough history, colonization, slavery, dictatorship in our country. So each time an African is writing, usually people think or want him to write about Africa and the struggle in the continent. So you will find a lot of novels who are very engaged, criticizing Europe, colonization, and so on and so on. But I try to do it in a kind of a comedy. So you can laugh about something which is serious. And I can say in the sense that I'm very engaged, or I'm very I used to criticize African system, but not only criticizing Europe, but at the same time I can criticize myself or my own country, and I need to be at the same time engaged and independent. So if I want to say something, I don't want to be like, yes, everything is bad because of Europe. I need to ask myself, where is my own responsibility? Because the main problem is how to recognize his own faults and try to correct them as soon as possible. So I can say, yes, I'm in the I'm a writer who is very engaged, but at the same time I'm very independent, and I don't think that even French literature is not engaged. Is a literature writing about sex is a kind of engagement. You're going to face feminist people, you're going to discuss about a lot of critics. We're going to say, yes, why? Well, Beck is talking about sexual tourism in this country. And so you're trying to explain the world. Or Marine Diaye writing about his little connection about with Africa. It's a kind of engagement. So maybe everything is engagement. Even a poem about love, you are trying to say to your lover that I'm very committed, you know, I'm trying to express you my thought, and you don't understand that the world is very bad without you. Huh? N'est-ce pas, Caroline?
I don't know if I heard you properly earlier. I think I heard you say, when you talk about Holden Caulfield,
yes,
that you cannot write about a territory, about a place, mm-hmm, before you are able to regret it.
Yes, but
can you say more about that? It seems like a wonderful thing to say, but tell us what it means.
Yes, because I used to write because I'm regretting something, because I'm living far from my country. I wrote a lot because I was living in France, and I felt at that time like my country was disappearing, and the only way to keep the drawing of my country is to write something so that I can go back in my mind, in my country. And it's the same thing. If I'm living in the country, it's very difficult for me to write about that country. Now I'm living in the United States of America. Even if people are saying, when are you going to write the novel we're expecting to you about America? I said, no, because I'm living in America. I need like to go far from America. Then I'm going to write something about America. So writing about something I'm looking at every day, it's not that easy, because you will face the reality. I need to forget the reality and to reinvent that reality in my book. So I need to regret America. For the time being, I have no reason to regret America. Every day I'm over there watching people, sunglasses, used cars, and Los Angeles Lakers, and so on. So that's not the way to write about that. Maybe when I'm going to turn maybe 65, going back to the Congo, and then I'm going to remember Santa Monica, Wilshire Boulevard, Hollywood, and something like that, and African people living over there, facing African-American, what kind of problem they have, what kind of situation in California were during the earthquake, and so on and so on. So I wrote a little piece about America in my book, called Letter to Jimmy, Letra Jimmy, about James Baldwin, African-American writer. It was like 10 pages about my meeting with Anne Clochard.
Clochard, yes.
My encounter about that guy. But it was about book. I met that guy who was reading The Invisible Man from Ralph Ellis. So it was like a shock for me. So I wrote something about that, and I was explaining that maybe in the United States of America, the white people are becoming invisible at the time. So I tried to express, yes, because they can see the black passing on the street, but since America is full of white people, they don't see any more white people. So the white people are becoming invisible in the United States of America. And that may be the way I can write a novel over there about a poor white man living in the middle of black people. let's wait and see.
your English is so good. Could you ever imagine writing in English?
No. It's difficult.
Not even when you're 65 and living.
I'm not Nabokov. He's very fluent, you know. He wrote Lolita because I didn't learn English at school. So I'm trying to learn on the street in Michigan, discussing with. And I used to teach in France when I'm in the United States of America. So that's not that easy. I cannot write a novel in English because all my background in literature is in France. Even English writers, I write them in France. It's now only I'm trying to read an English book written in English. So I need like to spend at least 20 or 25 years of immersion in English in order to dare to write that. I cannot write in English when I know that you have James Joyce, you have Beckett, or you wrote in France, you have a lot of Zadie Smith, Salman Rushdie, Hanif Qureshi. I know, they're going to laugh at me. That's all. For the time being, let me write in French, and then you're going to have a great job, you know, translating, yes.
I read somewhere that as part of your program at UCLA in the modern languages department, you do creative writing in French.
Yes.
It seems to me almost unimaginable that such a thing should exist in a modern language department.
Yes. It's the first class in creative writing in France, in the United States of America. So they used to see that, like, do you think that you're going to have students? Yes, we had. And I had like 15. Of them, whereas in some creative writing in English there was at 5. So that means that when people want to be writers, they don't care about language. The main thing is the inspiration, how you see the world.
Mm. Are they students whose first language is French or English?
No, they are American, voilà, Asian American, Indian American, African American. Sometimes I used to find a French guy lost in the middle of American people. So, voilà, invisible, yes, the middle. But mainly, like 99% are American, and we used to send them to France, like 1 year in Aix-en-Provence, learning with French people. And when they are back, very engaged in France, so we read novel in France, write in France, discuss in France, watch movie in France. That's very excited.
I've got two questions. One connected to the question on translation. What would your mother's word for negre be in her own? You said she was sans alphabet in her language. And the second question is that you said Europeans had a your travels, whether you might say something about the trip you're about to take, as I understand it, the pilgrimage to Lagos.
Ah. I think the first question was about my mother. Mm-hmm. Language. No?
Yes. What word would she use to translate negre into the language that she spoke?
Oh, okay. Yes. But the word negro in all languages is always very bad, because in Lingala is Ndombe. Ndombe reminds us something which is bad, the colonization, the slavery, and so on and so on. So we use another word to which can use like black. So instead of saying Ndombe, we used to say Moindo, which is black color, and without kind of prejudice or something like that. So as for my mother, or in our country, the main problem was the white color, because the devil in our country, the devil is white. That's the problem. So here, when I come here, the devil in the Bible is black with a tail behind and trying to frighten people. But in Africa, mainly in black Africa, the devil is white. So when we were like kids, we said, mind yourself, because if you go over there, you're going to meet the white people. So we are like threatened. That's why if you go to some villages in Africa, if they see a white, they're going to escape. It's not just because they are escaping the slavery, but because they think that I met the devil. He is coming over there. So in our language, nègre, or in French, it's not easy to express it in Lingala. And we don't express it because in our language we didn't include the Western reality. It's a language about our own landscape, our own universe in that sense.
There's one of the titles which is sewn into the text of Broken Glass is the title of a novel by your friend Daniel Laferrière, Haitian, who wrote a book called Comment faire l'amour avec un nègre sans se fatiguer,
yes.
Which we translated as which was translated into English as how to make love to a Negro without getting tired, which seemed to be an interesting change of preposition. And what was the second half?
The pilgrimage. Yes, I think that we are like 13 writers to go in 13 countries in order to write non-fiction. So I was committed to go to Nigeria, Lagos. I'm supposed to write about Lagos. I've never been over there. I overheard that it's sometimes very dangerous. So I'll go to face the situation. Maybe I'm going to write about how a city can frighten a writer. Right? So I don't know what I'm going to do over there. But I'm going to meet people during the day and during the night. I'm going to feel the beat from Fela, nice music. And I'm a little bit disappointed because when I'm going to get there, Nigeria won't be in the Mondial Cup because they are about to go home, you know. At least maybe I'm going to meet the players because they will be back from South Africa, so they can help me to write that book. So it's a nice project led by Chinua Achebe, who wrote Things Fall Apart. And I'm very delighted to go over there. They don't speak French, they speak only English and Pidgin. Plus, I did translate a writer from Nigeria, born in United States. His name is Izondima Iweala. He wrote Beasts of No Nation. So I translated his book from English into French in 2008 at Edition de l'Olivier, which is a small and good publisher belonging to Edition du Seuil, my previous publisher. So I'm going to see now and listen to the Pidgin and understand another part of Africa. It's a nice program.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.